able to.
Get a little better than that.
How come so many?
Welcome everybody to the May 20th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Sorry about getting started a little late here. Our Senate floor session ran a little long. We've got a bunch of stuff, so we're going to move pretty quickly, and I've got a whole bunch of members who want to testify. So we're going to be bouncing in and out of here. We're going to start off with open on 2832A. James.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2832A requires governing board or entity of public or private post-secondary institution to evaluate contract with third-party financial firm based on recommendations from United States Department of Education and Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Specifies contract may not include revenue sharing, per-use transaction fee on debit card, fee from initial disbursement via paper check or electronic funds transfer and account inactivity fee. Requires contract to be made public and posted on a website of post-secondary institution. Creates private right of action for students. Requires public university or community college contracting with third-party financial firm to undertake reasonable efforts to establish collaboration agreements with other institutions. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact has been issued. There is an amendment on OLIS, but that amendment is recently new and also in the works of being revised.
Okay. Not a lot of controversy on this one. Welcome, representatives, whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Over the past decade, Oregon students have borrowed more than $12 billion to finance their education, and well over half graduate with more than $26,000 in debt. The financial burden is well known and understood. Lots of our students depend on financial aid. At many colleges in Oregon, the access to their financial aid is through a debit card. They are stuck using a debit card that was arranged by their school, who contacted with a third-party financial firm. Last year, the Government Accounting Office said that contract terms between colleges and financial institutions should be more transparent, noting that students are supposed to have convenient access to financial aid money and to ATMs. The National Association of College and University Business Officers has issued best practices guidance to colleges and universities that encourages them to keep students' interests first, to negotiate low or no-fee financial services, and to make agreements transparent. The GAO released a report noting that student debit card contracts often include payments to schools from card providers based on the number of card accounts or transactions. As a result, schools encourage students to enroll in these card programs rather than presenting neutral information on all payment options. Students often believe that these debit cards are the only way to receive their financial aid to cover books and living expenses. Cards often carry the school logo or are linked to student ID cards. This can give the impression that the cards are official or required even for distribution of financial funds. By accepting these debit cards, students expose themselves to fees that can often be steep or frequent as they use their financial assistance. Common fees charged to students, and we're not saying that all of these are used at all Oregon schools, but these are examples of fees used by some Oregon schools and by some others around the country. The variety of fees includes a swipe fee of 50 cents each time they use the card, period. $25 to transfer money to another account, like one without a swipe fee. Two large providers charge a fee for card purchases using a PIN, the personal identification number, rather than taking the time to do a signature. In other words, you want to put in your PIN. There's a special charge for that. A fee to reload a prepayment card. $2.50 to use another system's ATM, like if you're off campus, not where that debit card's ATM is. You're off campus or you're at home. And simply to transfer the money to another regular bank account, there's a fee for that. And if you have figured out you didn't want to use that card because of all these different kinds of fees, there are instances of students being charged a $19 inactivity fee for not using the card. So What this bill does is it requires public and private higher education institutions, when entering into college card contracts with third-party financial firms, to consider federal guidelines issued by the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the U.S. Department of Education. That's the first thing. It asks them to consider the guidelines. Number two, it prohibits a few of the most troubling practices. Not all of those different kinds of fees I told you, but a few of them. It prohibits revenue sharing with the higher education institution, prohibits a transaction fee for debit or PIN transactions, and the inactivity fee. It also allows the student to receive the initial disbursement of the financial aid each term in a paper check or an electronic funds transfer if the student prefers, without being charged a fee, just simply to access their financial aid. On transparency, it will bring these contracts to light. The contract must be made available for public inspection and published on the higher education institution's website. Redress, it ensures that an enrolled student who uses a college card has a means of enforcing the law by using the court system if necessary. And finally, looking for a better deal and encouraging competition. The bill instructs public universities to make reasonable efforts to establish collaboration agreements with other public universities and community colleges to negotiate contracts for these services, with the idea that collaboration is a means of yielding a bigger pool of potential customers and attracting competitive bids. A bill is now being heard in the Senate that continues the direction to universities to participate in shared services. This bill is just taking advantage of that existing successful collaboration and expands it to this idea of financial services for student financial aid. This section is to encourage competition. It will create an opportunity for a better competitive market for Oregon banks and financial service companies and for better deals for students. You may hear about some potential federal action on this topic. The U.S. Department of Education recently proposed regulations. These are now available for public comment. I had a few minutes, just a few minutes, to look over them. They do appear to add some transparency and ensure better information, but they don't appear to offer the protections that this bill intends. Last year, while I was exploring the ideas for this kind of a legislation, I did have a couple of conversations with some staff at the National Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I heard about specific problems that they described to me in Oregon and in other states. I heard about the lack of federal protections, which they explained to me. I reviewed with them some potential regulatory approaches, and I was encouraged that it would be useful to pursue solutions at the state level. This bill will bring these contracts to light, and it will result in better deals for students. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative, I would just note, I don't know if you've had a chance to see the memo that I just got earlier this morning from the HEC, and they had reviewed the federal rules, and according to their analysis, the things that are not covered by the federal rules as it's proposed are the ban on revenue sharing, the ban on inactivity fees, and the right of private action. There are a few additional things that are not in there, that are not in the bill, that are in their regulations, which is publication of alternative accounts that students could have. Let me see here. I need some help. And I just want to get this on the record, requiring consent to send a card linking an ID, student ID card with financial aid, requiring efforts to provide no, requiring no-fee ATMs on campus, and bars and overdraft fees. So those are, the rest of it seems to be fairly similar. So I think the proposed bill and theirs have a lot of similarities and a little differences.
Yes.
So just get that clear.
Yes.
Representative Williamson.
Representative Holby.
Holby next. Okay. We let the House choose their way.
I'm back, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Paul Holby, State Representative District 8. Appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee on this particular issue. Though I realize a couple of you may remember this bill or similar bill from last session as well that we brought forward from the House to the Senate, and we're making that attempt again. This issue has been around for quite some time, actually, and we've been trying to figure out how to address it at the state level, because the federal government has been very slow at doing anything about this issue other than making recommendations. So I believe the House Bill 2832 before you today is based on many of those recommendations. And certainly we are, in this bill, directing our institutions, our schools in Oregon, what we would consider good policy for those contracts when we're dealing with students and their financial aid. And there is nothing that precludes us from doing that. And though the federal government may be moving forward with a rulemaking process, federal government sometimes doesn't move in the fastest arena, as I will note, because last session we actually were told, oh, the federal government's taking care of this issue, and this is over 2 years later, and now they're looking at rulemaking, which I think is a good thing, but not necessarily something that should stop us from moving forward with these proposals. I will note that these rules are already being challenged with a lawsuit that's been filed by the banking industry. So that makes this even, in my mind, more certain that we should go ahead and take action based on the recommendations of the CFPB and the U.S. Department of Education. So with that, the issues around this bill are I realize that our public schools and many of our schools, you know, have a right to contract out these services, and it does save them money. But the troubling part about this money-saving feature for our schools is that through the third party, they just add those costs onto the school. So they are cost-shifting the cost of administering financial aid from our schools to the students to compound their financial ability to get an education in this state. I think that policy, though I don't agree with, is not something that we're actually trying to change in this bill. We would just like to make sure that the contracts that our schools enter into it require some fairness in how these third-party financial firms are dealing with students when they're charging them fees that aren't really customary in the rest of the world. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'll turn it over to
surprised at your lack of faith in the federal government, Representative. Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, Jennifer Williamson, State Representative from the west side of Portland, House District 36. And I wanted to address a couple of issues that were brought up in the House around this bill, particularly the private right of action. But first I want to talk about, I'm assuming in the Senate you've been having the exact same conversations we've been having in the House Higher Ed Committee all session long, looking at absolutely every part of the higher education system to figure out how we make it more accessible and more affordable for students. And so this bill is part of those conversations, and I think that, as my colleague said, the nickel and diming that can happen with these accounts is truly stunning, and I know some students will come up and talk about the experiences that they've had. Some of the pushback that we heard in the House was the issue is the financial literacy of students. They should just know how to manage their money better. We don't need this bill. They should just figure it out. Well, I don't know if you've ever looked at any of these accounts, but even the best money manager would have a very, very hard time figuring out these different fees. And when students don't know that there are different ways to get their financial aid because it's discouraged, then I don't know that their ability to balance a checkbook, if anybody uses a checkbook anymore, it has nothing to do with the content of this bill. So the private right of action and why it's so important, and I'm troubled that the federal government did not address that at all. But the issue of having a university that right now is cost sharing, right? So financially, they have an incentive to get the most students, as many students as they can into a program. They are negotiating with a financial institution, and they are negotiating terms that will impact their students. In some universities, students are part of that conversation, but they're not party to that contract. And so if they, in the contract between the university and the financial institution, are making decisions about fees and the like, that impact students, the ability for the student to have no redress because the contract itself requires arbitration or mediation is, I think it's untenable because as a student, often you live on the edge financially. I was a student who counted every penny. If for some reason a third party financial institution had a problem with getting me my financial aid, it would have been a real problem around buying books, paying tuition, paying rent. And if I have no redress other than going to a mediator and an arbitrator that the third party financial institution has chosen, that is an accessibility issue for a student. And I think that we have to make sure that students have the ability to use our court system. There have been many class actions on these issues. They've settled all of them. And I want to make sure that Oregon students can be part of that process when the court system is used to make sure that, that students are fairly treated.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Drott.
Representative Hovey, what bank lawsuit are you referring to?
I think if you look at your document from the HEC from Dana Richardson at the bottom of it, it footnotes that you just got, that the banking industry has already expressed intent to file a lawsuit over these proposed rules, arguing that the Department of Education lacks the authority to implement them. And so having said that, that really, you know, does make me think there's a more dire need to pass this bill now. Because I don't feel that the federal government's going to act on this and be able to implement these rules very quickly. And there's nothing that should prevent us from putting these kinds of common sense requirements on these contracts our schools enter into.
Yes, please.
If the bank is going to file a lawsuit federally, don't you think that if we unilaterally pass the same thing, that they're going to file at the state level?
My answer to that question is no, because we are not doing the same thing here. We are not putting regulations on what the banks can and can't do. We are regulating the contracts and what can be in them. So they don't have any standing, and I'm not an attorney, but I would guess that they wouldn't be able to sue us for that.
I do have some more questions.
Ask away.
Okay. There's the federal law. There's over 300 pages of new rules and regulations, and by this timetable, that's supposed to be pretty much concluded by the last part of this year. Why don't we wait until that's done and find out so that we don't have to rewrite this law to conform to federal law?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't think we should wait. First of all, the federal government has promised action in the past. It didn't come. Just because 300 pages has been issued is no guarantee that there will be a successful conclusion to that process. Either it could be delayed or just not happen in the manner that it appears to proceed right now. I do believe by looking at the summary of what those regulations are intended to accomplish, and this is from the news release and explanation issued by the department itself, it appears that their regulations don't conflict with what the state of Oregon would require. They're not in conflict. There's nothing we would have to undo or redo to comply with federal law. They're addressing some different points in a different way. There is some overlap, but I think there might also be a few other things, even apart from the memo that the chair has a copy of from the HEC. For example, I really doubt that the section that's included on the collaboration to try to do multi-campus requests for proposal or multi-campus agreements, I don't see anything like that in the federal proposals, for example. I think that's a new twist that we're adding here in Oregon. It's not mandatory, it's voluntary, but I think it could result in something very good for Oregon business as well as Oregon students to compete with some of these other firms that are coming in from out of state.
Last one. The right of action that you seek, I would presume that would be against the university, or who would it be against?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Senator Drott, The bill itself says that you cannot preclude a private right of action on behalf of the student. So it would depend on who the student thought was the
guilty
institution that caused injury.
The guilty party would have to be the university. So it's going to cost a lot of money to the university, and I'm just kind of curious who's going to pay for this.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, I disagree. If I'm a student and I'm using an ATM that's the third-party financial institution's ATM, and somehow there's an issue and I don't get my money, there are lots of ways in which the third-party financial institution can be the one causing the harm because they're charging the fees.
Well, deep pockets are with the state, and so I think that since it was set up by the university, that you're setting the university up to be sued. And I can cite an example, and it's kind of a far-fetched one, but it's one over on the coast where a kid lost his arm at a park, and it wasn't the dory boat that was held liable. It was the state that was held liable. The state was the one that had the deep pockets. So I think you're setting universities up to take a fall on the right of action segment.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, I disagree. So I.
And certainly I would add that students don't necessarily have deep pockets and can't afford to, be subject to some of these practices and lose their financial aid monies, which are essentially subsidized by the taxpayer. And, I think that they need to be protected first.
Okay. Anything else? Senator Thompson?
Yeah. We could help students a lot more if we fund colleges at the proper level.
Yeah, there you go.
I totally agree, Senator Thompson. I totally agree with that statement. If we funded them at the correct mm-hmm. level, they wouldn't need to use these financial third-party firms, and they'd be doing it in-house like they used to, and it didn't cost the students anything at that point.
There we go. Anything else? Thank you. And let me ask you, since you're still all here, Representative Williamson, would you like to testify now on 2567?
No, I'll wait.
You'll wait. Okay. Same with
but
you, Representative
you.
Hovey?
Yeah, I'll wait for the bills to come up. And
I think you've got a comment on every bill on the agenda today.
that time of the year.
Okay, so thank you very much. We'll leave this one open. They don't want to hurry, and we'll just come on down the line. Eric Noel and Mario Parker Milligan, please.
Student Association.
We also have Representative Boone back there. Representative Boone.
And so our agenda is really tight, so to the extent you can be concise, it would be helpful. Definitely.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girod, and members of the committee, my name is Mario Parker Milligan, Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. This is, as the representatives mentioned, this has been an issue that students have been aware of and have been impacted by for quite some time. I believe Oregon institutions first started contracting with these types of financial firms in 2001, 2002. 2003 and 4, we started to see students across the state protest these contracts and the fees that were associated with these debit cards. And since then, some campuses have made changes to make the contracts better and to make fees less burdensome for students. But across the board, we don't see all institutions advocating for a better contract for students, which is why we're coming back again to the legislature to ask for a bit of oversight and stronger regulations on these contracts.
You want to introduce yourselves?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric. I serve as the student body president at Portland State University and am here representing the Oregon Student Association. So we'd like to start our presentation by quickly overviewing the situation and what we're talking about. As Mario mentioned, and prior testimony has mentioned, students, after paying tuition and fees, receive financial aid in the form of a refund or whatever's left over after paying those tuition and fees. Six institutions in Oregon, PSU, OIT, Southern Oregon, Lane Community College, Rogue Community College, and Mount Hood Community College all have contracts with a third-party financial firm called Higher One. And as you see on the graph on the right, Higher One represents the majority of the student debit card market. Some of the specific fees that we're going to address today and that students have identified issues with are the 50-cent debit transaction fee, itemed as the merchant-based PIN transaction fee on the fee schedule, and the $2.50 non-Higher One ATM fee. I would like to highlight that in 2013, Higher One Incorporated brought in a revenue of about $211 million. 64% of that came from account revenue, and that means, according to their quarterly statements, revenue that comes from fees associated to these student debit card accounts. We recognize that when we see a situation like this, when we have a third-party firm that receives the majority of its revenue from fees associated to the accounts that it holds, they act in a certain way as rational actors in the larger part of the system. And for students, when they receive their debit card in the mail and when they receive their financial aid, they have a couple of options. One, they can opt out of receiving their funding directly to the debit card and choose an electronic funds transfer or a paper check, or they can deposit their money specifically onto that card. And what we've seen from many, many students from either testimony or survey or even the analysis from the GAO and Department of Ed reports is that if students decided to choose an alternative method of disbursement, their funding is significantly delayed and that they are significantly disincentivized from opting into one of those two options. And if they are to put their funds on the card, then they are subject to an excessive and, we would argue, unnormal fee schedule with the debit swipe fee as well as a set of other fees. I will also note that the current fee schedule is attached as an exhibit to this bill on OLIS. Back in 2013, the Recognized Student Government at Portland State University surveyed over 860 students on campus. We were, at the time, in the middle of renegotiating the contract with Higher One Incorporated, and due in large part to the good relationship we had with the Director of Contracts Procurement, we were involved in the process to provide student feedback and to engage with the representatives from Higher One. And so we surveyed the student body on questions such as ATM access, refund distribution, the fee schedule, and customer service, as well as specific questions related to our campus. If we were to receive another ATM, where would students want to place that ATM? After we analyzed the survey results, we would note that 69% of students said they wanted an alternative to Higher One and were not satisfied with their service. 30% of those student respondents had used Higher One's customer service at one point, 26% saying that their service was good or excellent, and 45% noting that the service was poor or awful. When asked if students knew the fee schedule or were confident that they knew what fees were associated with their account, 22% said that they were confident that they knew the fees. And of those 22% of respondents, another only 22% said that fees were only 22% said that fees were reasonable and acceptable. To summarize a lot of the feedback we received from that survey, from, again, the GAO report and the Department of Education, we recognize that accounts are provided for students through those debit cards before they receive their financial aid and sometimes before they're even enrolled in classes. Students receive a debit card in the mail with instructions to set it up. As I mentioned earlier, students have a choice to choose a direct deposit or receive their funds on a paper check. When I went to set up my account through Higher One, and all financial aid, regardless of whether the student opts into a paper check or direct deposit, all funds are routed through Higher One regardless. It was a very difficult process. in addition to navigating the website and the strong warning colors of this will take much more time than just putting the funds directly on a student card, when I chose a direct deposit, not only did I have to enter in my bank account information online, I had to print out and either fax or mail a form to Hire One headquarters in Connecticut. And it took 2 to 3 weeks for me to receive my money. Had I selected the card, it would have been the next day. But then I would have been subject to a strong fee schedule. Students also do not have a choice in a marketplace. And they don't have options on the refund service that is provided to them. And I really want to highlight this point, because when we talk about comparing the fee schedule of Hire One or other third-party firms that provide debit cards to other banks like Chase or Bank of America, we also need to recognize that these third parties are the only option for students, and that there is no free market decision students can make, as opposed to setting up an account with a Bank of America or a Chase or a credit union. We've seen significant issues with transparency in the refund process, transparency in the fee schedule, and in students having access to the language and contracts with third-party financial firms, and that those contracts vary from institution to institution. Southern Oregon, Portland State, and Lane Community College don't charge the debit transaction fee, but the other three do, for example. Students regularly criticize the service for excessive and unusual fees assessed to them when they use their debit cards. And then we also see a significant lack of access to and experience from students that they receive poor customer service. Before I turn it back over to Mario, I want to highlight a specific story a student shared with us in the survey. The student said, "In 2012, I lost my Hire One card on the streetcar. I had called Hire One as soon as I realized it was missing, which was maybe an hour later. I was pretty concerned, not only because of someone spending my money or stealing my identity, but also because it had my TriMet Pass sticker on it. When I reported the card lost, I told the rep, if someone called because they had found the card, that I needed to get the card back because I would then have to buy 2 full-price monthly bus passes. The rep said they would call me if anyone found the card. Someone found the card and called Hire One. They said they wanted to get the card back to me. The customer service rep told them to throw the card out. They did not contact me as I had asked, nor did they get any contact info from the Good Samaritan who tried to help get my card back to me. This is why I'm unhappy with Hire One's fees. They are providing me no service, not to mention the obscene fee I was assessed when I was overdrawn during the summer, when obviously my account would not have activity on it as I was not enrolled in classes."
And lastly, to touch on the private right of action, Representative Williamson mentioned a couple of the lawsuits and class action lawsuits that had been filed against this company in particular. In 2012, they settled a lawsuit with the FDIC to the tune of $11 million for excessive non-sufficient funds fees that they were charging students daily on, multiple times a day on one transaction. And then in 2012, students across the country filed a class action lawsuit, starting in California, that soon started to add students from all over the country, including myself, against Hire One. This was settled in 2014, and since students, or former students, now have been starting to receive checks. My first term when I received the card, I opted to take all of my money out and put it onto my own credit union that I had had for several years since I was in high school. So I was one of the students who had some financial experience as an adult and pre-college. And it was hard to navigate. I moved all my money out and was still hit with inactivity fees because I wasn't using the account during the term. And then I was hit with overdraft fees because I had taken all my money out. So I had racked up hundreds of dollars during a time that I had chose not to use this account and move my money over. This student received a check for $3.68. I recently received a check for $61 out of the hundreds and hundreds of dollars that I lost and other financial damage that came from that. This is why we believe students do need another or need an option for recourse. Students are losing money on a daily basis that other customers and other banks aren't being hit with. That's why we're bringing this bill to the legislature's attention and why we care so deeply about setting some regulations at the state level. The federal government is moving, not moving quick enough, and we're seeing a lot of students fall through the cracks and a lot of Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars, federal Pell Grant dollars, a lot of loans being taken away from students in the form of nickels and dimes out of time, but those add up to dollars and, you know, tens of dollars and hundreds of dollars that aren't being used for legitimate educational purposes. And that's what worries us most at the end of the day, that we have a lot of money that is meant for educational purposes that is not being used for those reasons. So all of the proposed solutions in House Bill 2832 will address the major concerns that students across the state have, concerns with transparency, concerns with fee schedules, concerns with customer service, and so on. And at the end of the day, if there is an option for institutions to collaborate and work for a contract that works for multiple institutions, we think that's a good opportunity to get a fair and good deal for students in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see here. I only have two other people signed up. I'm wrong. I have three. Tim Martinez. Then we'll have Molly McGrew and Nellie afterwards. Come on, Tim.
Okay. Is Dana going to testify?
She's no longer here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez, sir, on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, as well as the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill today. First of all, I would like to thank Representative Nathanson and Representative Holvey. I was working with them in the House on the bill, and I think it has been narrowed slightly over there. So I do appreciate them working with us, and I'm continuing to work with them on this issue. I certainly don't disagree that there needs to be something done in this area. I do think that does need to happen. I'd also like to thank your vice chair for allowing me to try to get some amendments. I'll tell you what the association folks that I represent are opposed to, which would be the private right of action. We are not supportive of that. We do believe the bill as written and the amendments that we're trying to draft, I've talked to Representative Nathanson about this, and I'm confident that wasn't her intent, was to make sure the bill, should it go forward, is narrow enough so that it doesn't include other banking products. So, for example, my son is a University of Oregon student. He's never had one of these cards because he doesn't get enough money to ever have anything come back, and he has his parents writing checks frequently, it seems like, to the university. Thank God he's graduating next month. We want to make sure it's narrow enough that it doesn't affect other banking relationship that either the student or perhaps the parent might have. So those amendments continue to be drafted, and we will certainly get them to the administrator as soon as we have them. I do think it is important to note, and the other folks have talked about it, you do have 300 pages of federal regs on this. I guess I would disagree. I didn't think I was too naive, but maybe I am. They have put a due date on these rules final review of July 2nd of this year. So of July 2nd of this year, all the comments will be brought to the Department of Education to look at, and it's my understanding that shortly thereafter, I don't think it'll be years, although it is the federal government, so don't hold me to it, but shortly after that, these final rules will indeed be put into place. I would also agree with Representative Williamson. One of the problems we do have is financial literacy. You know, we don't offer that in most high schools, most middle schools. And so folks do go to college and have no idea what a checking account is or any of these things. That's not the financial institution's fault or the college. You know, that's, you know, if you want to put the burden on the parents, had a conversation earlier today with one of your members, put it on the parents as well. But, you know, when the schools don't teach it and don't make it a priority, I'm not surprised. I had a banker in the speaker's office. The speaker said, what can we do to help? How can we get you people that want to work? And a high-ranking member of one of the larger banks said, I can't find people coming out of school, coming out of college, that can read a financial statement, that know the difference between a credit and a debit. So, you know, it's not surprising that our students, our kids, go to these schools and get these things and have no idea what they're looking at. That's not a surprise. And again, I do think the federal government is addressing this, maybe slow. Representative Holby's absolutely right. You know, we have been talking about this for a couple of years, but it now seems like they're off the dime. So let me, if I could, just give you some of the things that I've seen in the rules. And I got to tell you, I haven't read the whole 300 pages either. I'd be happy to give copies to everybody.
I think we did get a pretty good summary of it from the...
Yeah, that is pretty good. And that's one other thing. I was waiting for the HEC representative to come back. I had not seen the document that Representative Holvey referred to, so I'm not aware of any lawsuit. We looked at that document. It refers to an article in The Hill, which is a newspaper in Washington, D.C. Nowhere in the article that she showed me, and she agreed, I don't know if she's back in the room yet because she's talking with her folks, but nothing in the article said anything about a lawsuit. It did say perhaps they were overreaching, but there's nothing in the article that's quoted in the materials you have that say banks are going to file a lawsuit. So real briefly, you know, again, as you did know, you are informed in writing under these federal rules that you are not required to open up account with these folks to get your money. The process must be clear on how you receive payment. It must be clear that you can get direct deposit if you would like, and that all payments should be treated equally. Also, you are also allowed to change how you want to receive that upon reasonable written notice, and of course the devil would be in the details on that. And the school must list issuing a check as an option for a student or parent. Now, it's unfortunate the previous speaker talked about how long it took, and I don't have an answer to that. That wasn't my folks. It's also very clear that the rules will require that the students or parents must have access to a regional or national ATM network. There must be an adequate number of these ATMs maintained so that sufficient funds are reasonably available, and students or parents must incur no cost for conducting transactions at these ATMs belonging to that surcharge-free network. Also must be clear this is not a credit card. And must not be convertible into a credit card. So I think that's a big issue as well. Again, must have a reasonable number of ATMs. And I think probably one of the biggest pieces that I would point out to the committee is that the college, the university, must post on the school's website the contract. So everybody will have access to that. It also must say total consideration for the most recently completed award year, monetary and non-monetary, paid or received by the parties under the contract, the number of students and parents who had accounts under the contract at any time period, and the mean and median of actual cost incurred by those account holders. The school must also submit to the Department of Education, the federal DOE, a URL for where the contract and summary can be found. So I think that really is key. I mean, the students are going to be able to go and say, this is what my school has either helped or perhaps hindered me in getting into this contract. The last piece I would say before I conclude, and I know the committee, because this bill has been around for a while, we certainly want to get as much of the educational dollar to be used for education. I mean, I think we all would agree to that. The question is, if these products, whether it's Hire One or my members, no longer want to bid on these contracts, how is that going to be delivered? It's going to have to be delivered by the universities or the colleges. They're going to have to set up a new program at a cost that also will take money away from educating students and our kids. So I would just conclude by saying we believe that the feds are definitely acting in the very near future. We would suggest, you know, we're going to be back here, I was thinking about last night, in less than 9 months, that this might be an issue to see what actually they do. If they don't go forward and they really make the July date meaningless, which, again, I'm not saying they won't. I mean, it is the federal government. I hope they're not listening. But that's our request. And if the committee, in its wisdom, does decide to go forward, the two amendments that we would like to see considered and adopted by this committee and by the Senate would be the private right of action and the amendment that we're working on language to make sure that the bill is narrow enough and does not affect other banking activities with their with students or their parents. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I went over probably a little bit than you wanted, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Ryder?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. The federal government said 2 years ago they were going to be acting, and it's been 2 years, and I see no reason personally for us to delay to wait for the federal government to do anything when we can do it now.
Okay. Anybody else?
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Molly and Nellie?
I think Dana just came in, too.
I'll give her a shot, too.
Chair Beyer, thank you, and members of the committee. We appreciate you giving us a few more minutes of your time to present some testimony on behalf of Higher One. For the record, my name is Molly McGrew. I work for State Street Solutions, and Higher One is our client. First of all, just to clarify, Higher One is a service provider. We are bound by two important facts of that service, one of which is the federal banking guidelines, because we are not a bank, and the second one are the federal guidelines as it relates to the disbursement of federal financial funds. To be a service provider, you have to comply with very complex rules and regulations, which oftentimes are determined outside the scope of our ability to forward things in a much more timely manner under which most people would like to have. I just want to take a moment and address that one piece because that seemed to be a salient issue in the testimony that was presented here today. What I really wanted to come and talk to you about is that as a result of the change in the federal banking guidelines, we believe that the important actions that have come forward do address some of the concerns the students have presented as well as the testimony from the representatives. Number one, just to review, the point of sales fees are no longer allowed under the federal regulations. This was an issue that was brought up in testimony today and in testimony under in the House. Secondly, the contracts will have to be disclosed publicly and with the following caveats. What the school would pay for the services if they chose to contract with Higher One, and secondly, what the revenue sharing model would look like for that institution. So those are also being addressed within this change. And then lastly, the information will be available not only on the university's website and available to all students who can access that, but as well as the Department of Education as a form of public record. Thirdly, under the new federal rules, Higher One cannot charge any fees at all within 30 days of a Title IV financial aid disbursement. Again, this addresses the issues that were presented in testimony in the House and also here today. Number four, any overdraft fees would be prohibited. And then lastly, the proposed federal guidelines go well beyond the scope of what is presented here today under this piece of legislation. And the final rule will be published in November of this year. And it will have an effective date of July of 2016. That is what we have been told.
July when?
July of 2016. I believe it's July 2nd.
So, yeah, again, the rules you're referring to are those that are posted as proposed rules
Yes, under the higher education rules. As a result of these changes that are already being done under the federal government, we believe you do not need to act on this bill today, as they do address the concerns that the students have presented to all of us here. And, of course, our primary issue is that we do not believe it allows them to have a private right of action, since those issues are being addressed.
Yeah. Molly, except for the private right of action, as you've read these proposed rules, where do you see that they're in conflict with the proposed bill?
They're not in conflict with the proposed bill. They'd be already okay. Done at federal level.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
She said July 2nd, 16.
16.
So a year from now.
Yes.
Thank you. Comment, Senator?
Yeah, our timetable says that the agency is to comment with all the issues and updates and respond basically to comments by late 2015. So
that'd be November. Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, it'd be November
dates.
That they have to have it finally published, sir.
All right, but that's, we would know what was going to be the law. Yes. In November of 2015.
Yes, sir.
It will go into effect in July of 2016.
That is correct.
Okay. Senator Riley.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that's quite correct. We would know what the proposal is, and we would know at some point later on what the actual action had taken, and we don't know when that would be.
I believe Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, we are under the understanding, as Higher One was a part of this entire process to begin with, that once the final rule is published in November, that it will take effect in January of 2016. So I'm just going by what they believe to be their active date.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Can I get Dana
in
here?
Dana, could we... I think we have some questions. Got a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if the HEC wanted to weigh in on this, so I'll give you an open-ended question. Where are the universities on this? They're not. I don't see anybody out in the room, and they definitely could be impacted by this. Those sort of questions. So I. Just like to give you an open-ended mic and let you say what you want to say.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee. For the record, Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I hadn't planned to testify on this bill today, but I appreciate being invited to speak to it. The agency is neutral on the bill. We did provide the information that the chair referenced. I should note that the link that it's in the footnote on the first page, it doesn't link to the proper article, so we will update that link for you. The universities, I believe in previous committees, did testify on the bill. The HEC doesn't represent the universities, and we wouldn't be the right people to speak on their behalf. So I don't want to get too far out over my skis here. I know the students probably could more accurately speak to their work with the universities on this bill. I hope that's helpful.
Not really.
I can see this. Sorry.
Well, one may assume, since they're not here, although we will ask, that they're not opposed.
Well, I think that needs to be that question. Do you have a position on the right of action?
The agency hasn't taken a position on this bill, no.
I'm pretty sure the HEC would not be the one getting sued.
Well, the HEC
we play our cards right.
The university
anyway.
Will be what?
If we play our cards right, we're not getting sued, but I suppose there's a way to get there.
Okay. Any other questions, Dana? Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Is there anybody from one or more of the universities here that wants to comment? Oh, we got one. We got two.
I know, exactly. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mary Moeller. I'm the Director of Local and Federal Government Relations at Portland State University.
John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association.
We did have, Portland State University did have one of our folks up at during the House Committee, and we talked a little bit about Portland State's contract and how we work with students to make sure that we are doing things in the best interest of students. Our students sit on our committee when they're choosing that contract.
Let me make this very clear and easy. Are you opposed to the bill?
No.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, we are not. We have had one concern with one amendment to it, the private right of action amendment, and just in that we were. Let me back up very quickly and say we really appreciated Senators, our Representatives Nathanson and Holvey working with us on this and got, I think, to a bill that is discreet enough that it it meets the needs of the students and doesn't have a lot of unintended consequences. The one piece that we were concerned may. Was the private right of action piece, and that it might just preclude us from being able to get contracts, whether they're with HireOne or anybody else in this area. And it, we didn't really have a chance on the House side to kind of get a lot of discussion about that idea. It kind of came up at the last minute. So that's been our one concern with the bill. Overall, we're comfortable with most of with the other elements in this.
Based on the fact that we've seen earlier, there were a couple of settlements to lawsuits, I would guess that's not an issue.
Yeah. Well, and Senator, again,
they obviously have been sued in other states.
It's a big enough of a question for us where we did, because we didn't. It was sort of put in at the last minute, and okay. It wouldn't be obviously in this case that they would be suing our colleges.
You're
it would
not.
Be
you got university people.
Well, I agree with the right of action concern. I just think it's setting up. I mean, you are the principal party that have contracted to a third party. So I would think that you would be subject to a right of action. But
that wasn't the concern that he was expressing.
I know, but that's, I think that they would come directly under it.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add? Any other questions, committee? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else, once again, who wants to testify on this bill?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
You know, for the last decade, I've been fighting to try to get more money for community colleges and more money for universities. And when I hear testimony that a lot of that money may be washed away and not used for actually educating our students, it troubles me a lot. So I do think that we need to continue to work on this issue and refine proper legislation.
We should recognize that I think that the universities who are in colleges that have used this have chosen to go to these rather than incur the expense of managing it themselves, and in some cases actually made a little money off of it. If you were to push them out of the business, then there's a different cost. You're just shifting the cost to another place, which will tend to flow across all students. But that's life. We're going to close public hearing. We'll open a work session. Do I have a motion? Anybody want to try one?
I want to amend it to get the right of action out of there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
I move that we pass this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, that's motion. We have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 2832A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on Senator Riley's motion. We have no discussion on the motion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gerard?
No.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. House Bill 2832A is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senators Thompson and Gerard in opposition. Senator Monroe, would you like to carry?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Well, you don't have to if you don't want to. I just thought you
would be happy to carry it.
Now, I should have asked the motion maker. Would you prefer to carry it?
It's okay if
Senator Riley would prefer to carry it.
I'm fine carrying it. I don't care. Either way.
Which would be?
I would like to comment since you haven't hit the gavel. This is just another trial lawyer bill. It really, truly is. And the right of action just absolutely stinks.
Okay. I'll be happy to carry the bill.
Senator Riley will carry it. We'll close on that. We will, let's see. What do I have here now? I have Senator, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2187. James and Representative.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2187A expresses policy position of state that regional transmission planning processes conducted for regions wholly or partly encompassing areas of state must adequately consider transmission of electricity from ocean renewable energy generated in Oregon's territorial sea or within adjacent federal waters. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments.
Welcome, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. It's nice to be in here. A little break from the rest of my work.
Okay.
For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I bring you a bill that came out of the House Energy and Environment Committee with a unanimous proposal, no opposition, no cost to the state, and the House floor vote was 57-1 with two excused. And this is very, very briefly, it's a very simple bill that we found necessary to draft and hopefully pass out of here too. It finds and declares policy position of Oregon relating to consideration of ocean renewable energy in regional transmission planning processes. And this is like many of my other bills that I go through that I bring to you and others in this body, there are bills that address a little problem in the law. For this example, we did some years ago the territorial sea plan. We didn't, when the ocean planning process was going on, they didn't anticipate wave energy, so they changed the plan to address that. This is somewhat the same in that for transmission planning, we're just asking the state to make it part of their policy to include ocean renewable energy in that planning process. And I'm going to hand the mic over to Jason Bush, who's director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jason Bush. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust, OWET. Very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today and to Representative Boone for sponsoring our short bill. I'd like to keep my comments about as short as the bill. In brief, I think the most important thing to talk to you today about is what is the impetus for this bill? Why do we think this is a good idea? OWET is a state-funded organization, 501c6, and we've been funded by the Oregon Innovation Council for the last 8 years. And we set out with the mission to promote, attract, and build the marine energy industry in Oregon. And in many ways, we've been very, very successful. This is still a pre-commercial technology, but Oregon is the national leader in this emerging technology sector. We've worked with OSU, Oregon State University, to help build the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center, NIMREC. I know it's a mouthful. There's also SHMIMREC and HIMREC. But we have the flagship organization right here in Oregon. It's a federally funded program. We have created the most expeditious permitting process in the United States. We passed the aforementioned Territorial Sea Plan, which identified sites in the state's waters where you can do an ocean energy project with minimal impact on the ocean and its users. We have funded numerous environmental studies, and we have attempted to provide a great deal of data to help ease the process of integrating marine energy into the grid when it is commercially viable. However, we are state-funded, and we recognize that there will be a day when we no longer have the revenue to do the kind of things that we do on a regular basis. And that's why we have begun to work with our regional partners to make sure that there is a web of knowledge and support for this industry when OWET is no longer there to make a phone call or to lean on someone. House Bill 2187 is part of that effort. When we're not here to go to WEC meetings, Western Electricity Coordinating Council meetings, or to talk with the people on my board from Bonneville Power Administration or PGE, we hope that this bill will ensure that our regional transmission planning bodies will be thinking about the opportunities that marine energy presents and plan for it, plan for the integration of this new source of energy into the grid. The mechanism by which it does that is pretty simple, and that's relies on House, FERC Order 1000, as I described in the brief discussion paper I sent to the committee. FERC Order 1000 requires regional transmission bodies to consider the priorities and policies of the jurisdictions that operate within their operating areas. So by passing House Bill 2187, we've made a statement as a state that we would like them to be thinking about this energy source in the future. Most importantly, the regional transmission bodies will start accumulating data. They'll start vetting that data. And most importantly, I suppose, implementing that data into the models that they use that lie at the heart of the regional planning. And if we succeed in doing that, then we can be assured that the state of Oregon will be ready when the technology is ready to bring the maximum amount of economic development and clean energy onto the grid here in Oregon. So I'll conclude my comments there. I'm happy to answer any questions if I can. Thank you very much.
Any questions, committee? Thank you very much. I appreciate Senator, Representative Boone, excuse me.
That's the first time anybody's done that. Thank you. I just wanted to add one more piece. Many of you know that I've been working on the Oregon Resilience Plan for a long time, and this is one of the top priorities of the plan is to work on getting the energy grid back up once we have this big event. And it would be It's just a step ahead, I think, to start looking at power generation from the west instead of from the east, because we will be cut off, and our transmission will be down what we have now. And this is something that we will be without. Otherwise, we'll be without electricity from the east side of the or the mountains for 3 to 4 years. So this is it's one of my top priorities is to get our energy back up so that we can get our commerce back up, our kids back in schools, and start rebuilding.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. You. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2187? Don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2187. We'll open a work session on 2187. Chair moves House Bill 2187 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 2187A moves to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry?
Sure.
Senator Rowlands carry. We'll close on that one.
Mr. Chair, I want to make a comment.
Uh-huh.
2832, House Bill 13, that we passed just before this one, to serve notice of a minority report.
Okay. We'll take note of that, and we've all I've seen Representative Johnson here someplace. Is he here? Yeah, there he is. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2941. James, Hovey, and Johnson. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2941 updates language in ORS 757.603, requires electric company to provide portfolio rate options to residential electricity consumer that includes option for electricity associated with a specific renewable energy source, including solar photovoltaic. If Public Utility Commission finds through public comment or market research conducted by electric company that demand is sufficient, directs PUC to evaluate programs to incentivize development and use of solar PV energy systems and submit report to legislature that recommends most effective, efficient, equitable approach to incentive programs for each program. Recommendation on whether programs should be discontinued, modified, extended, or remain unchanged. List factors PUC must consider in developing recommendations. Requires reports to be submitted in interim legislative committee related to energy on or before September 15, 2016. Declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, and has a minimal fiscal impact.
All righty. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing us to testify on this bill. I'll start out. This bill originated as a bill about trying to implement community solar in the state of Oregon, providing another methodology for consumers to participate in renewable energy, specifically solar. The bill has gone through a reiteration, and the community solar aspects of the bill are still under conversation, and hoping that those conversations continue. I know Senator Johnson helped work on the amendment to the bill that does provide another REC program for the IOUs,
It was an amendment that did pass the House unanimously and comes to this committee at this point, and I'll let him continue from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52 from Hood River. And I might note for the record, I don't know that I've ever occupied a joint testifying position with this good representative here. So thank you for that opportunity today in front of your august committee. This was, I think, one of the bills we passed out of our House Environment and Energy Committee that I think I'm most proud of. I think it really addresses a need, and that need is that we need to be taking more of a comprehensive look at the variety and the number of solar photovoltaic programs and incentives that we currently offer in the state of Oregon. For good reason, every time we come together as a legislature, you know, somebody comes up to us with a good idea about, we'll try this because we think this will work and this will help to incentivize customers to engage in this kind of, these kind of programs and such. And what we end up with after multiple sessions is we kind of stack program on top of program on top of program without really looking at and doing a comprehensive evaluation of which programs really are effective and which programs really are designing as working as they were intended to and so forth. And that's what's the intent is in the amendments that we got, and I think primarily in section 2 of the bill if you look at that. But basically, and again, I need to add that the PUC did come to us at the committee level and said, you know what, we would love to be able to take a comprehensive look at all of our solar voltaic programs that we currently have in effect, make an evaluation, do some cost-benefit analysis, and then come back to the legislature in time for the next session so we can go forward implementing and care, you know, making available those programs that really do have, are having the outcomes that we're all looking for, i.e., which is reduction of carbon and so forth and so on. But if we're going to do it, let's get some alignment on what we're doing so we don't have these one-offs going all over the place. I think right now there's as many as 6 different solar PV programs out there for residential customers and stuff. So this is about trying to winnow that down and get down to the programs that are working as intended. And just to, as you look at the legislation there, as the proposed legislation, they're going to look at the value, meaning are we getting the outcomes that we thought we were going to get from this program, and what are the costs, not just for the program itself, but what are the costs of those that don't participate, i.e., what potential cost shifts could there be because one person's, specifically, I guess I'd refer to net metering. I think you understand how that works. If somebody is creating their own solar electricity and stuff, the meter, in fact, kind of runs backwards for a little bit. Well, that means perhaps they get a check at the end of the month, but the guys down the block who don't participate are really bearing most of the cost for line maintenance and so forth as well. So those type of conversations, I think, would be helpful to have, as well as what could be done to minimize some of the confusion and again, the cost to the participants, because some of these programs can be a little confusing to engage and participate in as well. So so I think it's a good piece of legislation. I think it's timely and needful where we are in terms of trying to really incentivize solar in the state of Oregon. This is not intended to create disincentives or to remove those abilities, but to really clarify what we're doing. Let's focus on those programs that are effective, and let's go forward and try to do all we can do as a state. So with that, I know there's a lot of folks that can fill in some of the gaps behind us.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that though you're aware that a conversation we had, which really wanted to look at what, potentially an amendment to this bill that would further specify to the PUC some recommendations coming back to us on the community solar aspect and solar in general as well.
Correct. Yeah, and I should mention, committee, that this is one that we're still a work in progress, if you will. We're still looking at some amendments that need to come back, and so we will not be acting on this bill today. But since we had it posted, we did want to give people a chance to comment now if they wanted to, or wait until next week when we have the other amendments. So, there questions?
Thank you.
Appreciate your comments. I do have others signed up, and well, let's see here. Varner Seaman, Elizabeth Howell. We will get another shot at this, so.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'll be brief. Varner Seaman testifying on behalf of Portland General Electric. We support passage of 2941. We also understand that there's some amendments coming back. As the folks in the last panel said, essentially the bill does two things. It allows that if folks, either community members or a utility, brings forward a case for a tariff that would allow a type of community solar project, that the PUC can entertain that and adopt such a tariff. PGE has been working for the last few years on a program that we intend to roll out before too long here, essentially a voluntary solar program where people who don't have access, or even if they did and they aren't interested in putting rooftop solar on their house, they could pay into a program where they're buying a share or on a month-to-month subscription basis, buying the output from a particular solar facility. That facility we've contracted with in a power purchase agreement with a project that's going to be in the Willamina area, and we're excited about that program rolling out. Part one of the bill would enable us to be able to have some statutory cover for being able to roll that program out, and we think this is a good thing. Figuring out how you do the economics on community solar is a little bit tricky. Who pays for it? How do you make sure we've got the right value streams? Making sure that folks who are non-participating aren't having to pay for the cost of someone else's decision to participate in such a program, and making sure that the economics work out so the project can come online and be successful. So we're supportive of that first part of it. And then, as Representative Johnson was talking about, the second part of this bill we actually think is a pretty important piece. The PUC is going to be doing some work over the next several months to establish what the proper valuation of solar is, what the benefit and costs are for the state of Oregon, for customers, both in terms of resiliency, impacts on the grid, and what the essentially coming up with what's the right price to be paying for solar. This part two of the bill would have them at the end of that docket come back and make some recommendations to the legislature on how we should be structuring these solar programs around the country. How you structure solar has become a pretty intense topic in lots of different jurisdictions. We think the PUC is the appropriate body to take a pretty measured look at how we should be structuring these programs. They've got the resources, the expertise in terms of rate setting, and we think that that's a pretty good way to go forward. And just lastly, putting together community solar projects and voluntary programs for customers is an important thing for both PGE, and I think it is for PacifiCorp as well. Respectively, we're the number one and number two utilities in the United States of America to have customers voluntarily signing up for our programs. We take these pretty seriously. We think moving into some of these community solar programs as we go forward is a good direction. Our customers want us to do that, and we support 2941. Just want to remind folks, this had an 8-1 committee vote in the House, and it passed the House floor 58-2. So with that, thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I'm here representing Pacific Power. As Varner mentioned, we have a very successful program, voluntary customer program called Blue Sky, and that program has been building projects. Actually, earlier this year, we announced 10 projects, solar projects within our service territory that our Blue Sky funds will be building, funding to build. But it is an interest of our customers to have a more direct connection to a solar project or a renewable project. And so this bill will allow us to create a program similar to what PGE has been working on to meet that customer demand. So we're very supportive of this, of House Bill 2941 going forward, and also of the study as, you know, the PUC is going to come back to you with recommendations about how best to incentivize solar. We have lots of solar programs in Oregon, and we think their recommendations on how to do it well is going to be a really valuable bit of information for us and for you in the future. So with that, please support 2941. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thanks very much. James Valdez, Ricky Stephen, and Mark Pengelly.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill 2941.
My name is James Valdez, and I represent an organization called Northwest Sustainable Energy for Economic Development. I also wanted to thank the other representatives who've worked extensively on this, Representative Holvey, Representative Vega Peterson, as well as the Public Utility Commission, who has helped craft this so far, and your leadership in moving this forward is appreciated. While well-intentioned, we do have some concerns with the bill version as it stands. And I guess I would like to clarify that it really, as Representative Holvey mentioned, is not a community solar bill. And with all due respect, I think we take a little bit of an exception to the utility characterization of their existing programs and their planned programs as being considered community solar or community shared solar or community solar gardens. They're programs which we do support the existence of voluntary renewable energy programs, but those are structured to where a customer pays more each month for the renewable energy certificates from resources that are built and developed. It does not usually result in any bill savings for participants and does not mirror the benefits that would flow from a customer installing solar on their property and realizing energy savings over time. Community shared solar, which has been deployed around the nation in a number of other states successfully, does do that. And so we see the current bill as a bit of a duplication of existing efforts that are underway. We recognize that the Public Utility Commission has a value of solar docket open, and we think that that will be a valuable addition to the policy landscape. We don't think that programs should be stopped or that new progress should be hindered by having to wait for those evaluations to happen when there are good ideas that can move forward. I'll be brief, but I did want to talk about some of the components that we see that should be in a true community solar bill that we feel are missing. And so we do feel that the following elements would be necessary for success. Participants in the community solar project should be able to subscribe upfront and then receive benefit through bill credits that would reduce their bill. These participants should be able to engage in a way through participation ownership that involves a diversity of entities, and we should encourage competition and innovation in this. The legislature should set a target capacity of what we're trying to achieve in developing community shared solar projects and also an implementation date to actually see projects happen. This really enables community shared solar enables people who don't have property that they can install on directly to receive benefits from the investment of that they're putting into the energy infrastructure. Participants should also be able to self-organize and develop projects through subscriber organizations, including nonprofits and including renewable energy cooperatives, which is something that this very committee helped enable in Senate Bill 1520 last session. And so we feel that would be a valuable component. We do hope to work, as you mentioned, Chair Beyer, with other stakeholders and with the Public Utility Commission to develop some amendments to this bill. But we do want to also make it clear that this, as it stands, is not a community solar bill, though it does seek to address some important issues. And I thank you for all of your time and consideration on this
topic.
Thank
you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Ricky Seguin, and I work as the director of Environment Oregon. Environment Oregon is a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization. We have over 40,000 members and supporters across the state. And first, I just wanted to say thank you to Senator Beyer, Reps Holvey, and Vega Peterson, as well as the PUC, for taking on an issue as important as community solar and really working hard to try to come up with a robust program that works to help more Oregonians invest in a solar future. And as an advocate for community solar from the beginning, we're highly supportive of the idea to continue working on the creation of a program that really comes up with a community solar program that works for Oregon. But to echo what James said, respectfully, this bill is not that at this point. It's also worth noting that the bill right now, the investor-owned utilities do not need this legislation in order to proceed with their voluntary REC programs. And really the thing I want to stress is just how much public support there is behind the idea of community solar. Since January 2015, so this year, Environment Oregon has talked to over 10,000 Oregonians about this topic, as well as a couple of other solar policies. And I can't stress enough that community solar is the idea that folks gravitate to the most. The figure is about 3/4 of roofs in the state aren't appropriate for solar panels. Community solar allows another option for folks to actually participate in this solar future. And like James said, there's 11 states in the country who have already come up with community solar programs that are functioning quite well and differently in each state, and worth looking at each of those. And like James said, as we talk to folks and Environment Oregon members about how community solar works, the basic, most important principle is that participants would receive benefits, would directly receive benefits from their investment in the program. And also there's a diverse set of businesses and entities who are able to own, develop, and market the community solar garden. So I think it's essential as we move forward that we come up with a program that fits within that framework, that what we're hearing from individuals and from businesses is what they're looking for. And to conclude, let me just give you a sense of the support that's out there. Like I mentioned, since January, we've been doing this outreach, and so far, over 3,500 Oregonians have signed on in support of a community solar program in Oregon. 60 businesses have endorsed this, including Tofurky and Hood River and Keene Footwear in Northeast Portland. We received endorsements from 40 city councilors, mayors, and county commissioners across the state. And we've held 11 different town hall meetings concerning this topic that have brought in over 275 individuals who are excited about the idea of community solar as well as other good solar policies here in Oregon. So with all of the overwhelming support at your back, I urge you to proceed with an excited sense. We're ready to work together with you on this, so bring us in as much as you can, and I'm happy to take questions. But thank you for your leadership.
Thank you. Mark?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. On behalf of Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress, we are a nonprofit that advocates for the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy in ways that will benefit our state's economy. The bill has two parts, as you've heard. I would like to address my comments to the study part of the bill, Section 2. I have two major concerns. One is that the criteria for the study may be insufficiently broad and may not give you all the information you need to make wise policy choices. The second is this does not call for a report back to the legislature until September of 2016. This is problematic because, as you may know, there is a 30% federal tax credit that applies to all of these renewable energy projects, and it goes away in December of 2016. So if you look at Section 2 of the bill, you'll see that it talks about costs in several places, but it does not talk about benefits. It does not consider environmental benefits. It does not consider the larger economic benefits to the state that would result from generating more renewable energy in this state. Increased employment, increased tax revenues, recirculating these dollars in our local economies. Oregon sends about $12 billion out of state for fossil fuels each year. So we have never quantified the impact to this state of generating energy within the state as opposed to outside of the state. This study would not look at that, and I think as policymakers, you want to consider not just the expense and efficiency of these projects, but also the benefits. I think the analogy might be if you were trying to decide whether to build a plumbing system, and you looked at the cost of pipe, and you looked at the cost of trenching, and you looked at the cost of plumbers, and you looked at right-of-way acquisition and all of that, but didn't think that it was going to give you water to bathe in and water to drink and water to irrigate your crops and swim in public pools and so forth. So I think to have these things have not traditionally been within the PUC's mandate, but there are things which you as legislators would want to know in making your broader policy decisions. So I would suggest at a minimum that in Section 2 of the bill, you add that the PUC should consider the benefits to the utility, its ratepayers, and the state, including environmental benefits from the development and use of solar photovoltaic energy systems, to the extent that those benefits are not included in the resource value of energy, and also consider the economic benefits to the state from the development and use of distributed solar photovoltaic energy systems. As I mentioned, this report is not due until September 2016. This would deprive Oregonians of the ability to claim this 30% federal tax credit from now until then. And I'm concerned that this may sort of paralyze the development of solar resources in this state pending the receipt of this report. So I think it would be much better if we had a much shorter timeline or provided for new solar programs to be implemented during that hiatus. Lastly, I would say that a study with very similar language was ordered by House Bill 2893 in 2013, and a report was issued by the Public Utility Commission in July of 2014 and was updated in January of this year. It was inconclusive and probably didn't give you all the answers that you wanted. So if this report is to be helpful to you, I think there are some broader considerations that it would be very beneficial to include in the mandate for the PUC to consider. Lastly, I want to thank you, Chair Beyer, and Representative Holvey, and the Public Utility Commission for all of their work and leadership on this issue. Thank you.
Questions? Like I say, this is one that we have a little work to do on yet, and hopefully we can fine-tune some of Mr. Perrin-Gidley's comments or concerns into the final bill that we consider.
I think we can do it. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Bissonnette? Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board, representing residential ratepayers. One of the advantages and disadvantages of speaking last is that you didn't have a chance to say what everybody else has said, so I can be brief. CUB supports the bill. All of the characterizations around this isn't a community solar bill, but still have work to do on it, we agree with. We think that there's value in doing their proposed study. Good bill, should pass. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions?
Thanks for being so short.
I'm not getting any taller.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify today on this bill? Seeing none, we will carry this bill over till next week, and we'll close on it for today. And we will, let's see, we're going to try one more. We're going to open on House Bill 2193.
Mr. Chair, James. Committee members, House Bill 2193A defines energy storage system as technology capable of retaining energy, storing energy for a period of time, delivering energy after storage. Defines electric company as company with sales of electricity to retail customers amount that equals 3% or more of retail electricity sales. If authorized by PUC, directs electricity company to procure one or more qualifying energy storage systems with capacity to store at least 5 megawatt hours of electricity on or before January 1st, 2020. Restricts total capacity of storage system procured by one company to less than 1% of company's 2014 peak load. Authorizes PUC to waive limit under specified circumstances. Allows energy company to recover in rates all costs prudently incurred in procuring one or more energy storage systems not later than January 1st, 2017, directs PUC to adopt guidelines for one or more proposals for developing project that includes one or more energy storage systems, establishes proposals requirements and PUC's evaluation criteria, prohibits PUC from using or allowing use of information analyses submitted with proposal to be used for other purposes and to protect information, directs PUC to determine procedures under which person may view information analyses and adopt protective order that includes reasonable restrictions requested by utility, directs PUC to report interim legislative committees related to energy by September 15, 2016 and September 15, 2018, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact and has minimal fiscal impact. We do have a dash A8 amendment. It changes the definition of electricity company to company that sells electricity to 25,000 or more retail electricity customers, permits PUC in consultation with the Oregon Department of Energy to waive energy storage limit if one or more electric utilities as defined in ORS 757.600 participates in procuring and sharing benefits and costs of storage system. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact with that amendment.
Representative, quickly.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I appreciate the testimony. I think your committee administrator described the bill, so I won't attempt to do that. I think House Bill 2193 is really a huge step for Oregon, and I would consider this the best energy bill of the session as opposed to what the previous bill. But having said that, this bill does provide a lot of opportunities for Oregon in helping stabilize the grid, helping resilience, a whole host of other issues, and most importantly, helping us integrate renewables into the grid. And I appreciate all the work of the PUC on this. I won't speak directly of the Dash 8. I'm supportive of the underlying bill, and I'm supportive of the bill with the Dash 8 amendments as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Any questions, I should say. Thank you, Vonner. And let's get the Renewable Northwest people up here, too. Hillary and Diana? Come on, come on. This affects PGE. And Pacific, but I guess you're speaking for both today?
Past, present.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric, speak on behalf of PGE. We support the bill.
Super.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Hillary Barber with Renewable Northwest. We are very pleased to support the bill as well. Hard to underscore the benefits of storage for renewables and the future of renewable resources. The benefits are numerous, and Dina can speak more to those specifically. But this bill would also set Oregon in a direction that other states are going in terms of showing a strong interest and policy direction for storage. So pleased that you're considering it and happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dina Dubson-Kelly, and I'm with Renewable Northwest as well. And I don't have anything to add right now. I'm just happy to answer any questions you have.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So we're following Tesla, is that right?
Not necessarily.
Senator Beyer, Senator Riley, storage can mean a variety of different technologies. People often think batteries. One of the things that's great about this bill, and I think Representative Holvey did a really good job in drafting it, in that it's agnostic to the technology. We don't know what the forward cost curve is going to be. Some of these things, I mean, we have, so PGE owns and operates a 5-megawatt storage facility here in Salem, the Salem Smart Center. So we've got some sort of foray into this technology, and we think batteries certainly are a pretty easy to think of technology, but we could see some pumped hydro, some flywheels, and things that are a little bit more exotic going
great,
forward.
Thank you.
And just for the record, we're going to be doing a tour for House Energy Environment, I think, on June 4th of that facility, so folks from this committee would also like to attend. You're more than welcome to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Riley, just briefly to say we also strongly support the bill being technology neutral. We think that's really important, and we would also just highlight that it's important to consider not only supply-side technologies but also demand-side technologies, which currently are very cost-effective, such as demand response and those types of solutions. So just add that in there.
Thank you.
Just for the record, as I read this bill, now, Director, to you, Vonner, my understanding is that directs it to look, the PUC to look at it, but still to apply their same cost standards to it?
Senator Beyer, there was some negotiation back and forth on the language, and we actually the structure of it is they have to develop a rule, we make proposals, and then they take a look at those proposals, and we expect the questions of prudency and cost to be included in those reviews. Yes, sir.
I assume this would take place in within the integrated resource planning process. I'm looking at Jason. I'm looking at Jason. He's not sure. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it looks like it's supposed to be, or at least my understanding of it is that it would be in conjunction with the integrated resource planning process and serve as a complement to that process. So looking at the two together, there would be a separate process here, but would also take into account what's happening in the integrated resource planning process.
Senator Beyer, my understanding, recently acquired, is that Public Utilities Commission is going to open a docket to investigate this. These evaluations in terms of the proposals may or may not end up being part of the integrated resource plan, but I think it's to be determined in terms of how that docket goes.
Still, I assume it would be falling into prudency.
Yeah.
Cool. Other questions?
I just got Go ahead.
Senator Tom? Wait a minute. Go ahead.
The quick question I have, since you were talking about storage, hydrogen technology has kind of been a little bit at the forefront here lately. Would that be included in the storage model? I see a nod back there. Do you know what I'm talking
about? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The hydrogen technology, would that be a form of storage that is included in this?
In the Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, yes.
Okay.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah. What's the limit? Is there a limit to what you can spend, or can you just spend as much as other? Because most of this is going to be paid by consumers. Is there a limit to what you're going to spend a year on this? I mean, could this be, you know, I've got figures that show that PGE alone could spend approximately $975 million for your utility on storage.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, the way that the bill is drafted, it has a floor of 5 megawatts. And then a ceiling of 1% of your peak load. For us, that'd be roughly about 40 megawatts. I haven't seen an analysis that we've done on what the upper end cost could be. So I don't know about that amount. I mean, for what it's worth, $1.6 billion is our total annual revenue. If we were to spend $1 billion on storage for 40 megawatt hours of storage, that'd be a pretty... I think that'd be a pretty big rate-busting thing for us at those levels. I don't think that the PUC would approve that, and frankly, I don't think we'd be interested in having those types of rate impacts to our customers. Our intent really, and I think that what we've seen is that similar to some other technologies, the cost of storage is coming down. There's some interesting battery research and development that we understand is taking place. Actually, some of it's taking place in the Portland metro area where they're looking at some new technologies to try to cut the cost of it. I think cost is certainly a concern, and we think that there are some controls through the regular PUC process where customer groups, ICNU and CUB, we fully anticipate to be engaged in this and have a say in terms of the prudency review. I take it that Senator Beyer's question was really around, you know, are those stakeholders and the people who really are very concerned about costs to make sure they've got a place to keep those types of spends from occurring.
I would just add, Senator, that the trade-off is if you don't have that, to the extent you have variable resources, you have to build more generation. So it's kind of a trade-off in there, and that's what the PUC is supposed to do, is measure all of that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and not just for variable resources, but also avoidance of transmission expenditures, too. You could avoid building a substation with certain types of storage technology. So there are a lot of cost-saving opportunities with it as well. And we're very confident that the PUC process is going to look at costs and benefits, too, and that the proposals that the utilities would bring would
all
take
right.
that into account.
I've got to move people along here. So is there any other questions to this group? Mr. Bissonnette, you want to comment? Mr. Huser, I think it's your amendment that's set in there.
I got to go to another hearing.
Okay.
Meeting. Are we going to vote on this?
We're just about done.
I got another
Jeff?
2 hours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. This bill has been in, has had a lot of work done on it, has good cost containment, good consumer protection, something we need to be practicing. I'll echo all of Representative Holvey's comments on the bill, and we are in support of passage of the bill.
Okay. Jason?
For the record, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, Jason Huser from the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and I've been deputized to speak on behalf of Oregon's other 35 consumer-owned utilities in support of the Dash 8 amendment. This is really a technical amendment. We were concerned about some language in the bill that was borrowed from the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard statute. We think that language could be taken out of context. Felt there was a more appropriate way to apply the bill to PGE and Pacific Power. So the Dash 8 is substitute language that's been utilized in the past.
So you want the typical consumer electric belts and suspenders exemption?
I suppose that's one way of saying it, Senator.
I get it.
Very good. So if there's any questions, I can handle those. And real quickly, I do want to say we agree with Representative Holvey that storage is very important to Oregon's energy future. We're involved with two pilot projects with the Bonneville Power Administration. So I do want you to know there is efforts in storage going on outside of investor-owned utility territory.
I get it. Any questions of this group? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 2193? One more shot. Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I left you off. Come on up. It's Justin. I forgot. Somehow I checked your name already.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Justin Rainey, I'm here today on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, and we have concerns with the bill, primarily to the limits to the questions that Senator Thompson was raising. We're not opposed to efforts to develop renewable energy storage. We do feel that the private marketplace is the best place for this to occur, but the way the legislation's drafted, it sets minimum of 5 megawatt hours that would be procured. We're not really concerned with that lower number. Our cost analysis showed that a 5 megawatt project would translate into roughly a $3 million cost for ratepayers in 2020. So not a substantial cost, something I think we could live with. Our concern lies in the upper end of the cap that's placed in section 2, subsection 2A of the bill. On the upper end, I think PG alluded that they would procure 1% of the 2014 peak load. When we ran the numbers, had our attorney sort of look at that, they came back with cost estimates that could be as high as $275 million. While we don't believe that the PUC would adopt or approve such a high number, we do think it would be practical to try and lower what's set in statute so you have cap limits that are closer to one another. We would ask that the committee consider an amendment that would adopt a cap or cap the project at a 20 megawatt level so that you would have a minimum of 5 megawatts and then you'd cap. So essentially delete section 2, subsection 2A, and just place a set megawatt standard that's lower than currently drafted in the bill. We feel that this cap would give ratepayers more protection and more certainty as we move forward and look at qualified renewable energy storage. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Justin, I appreciate your concerns on cost, and I'm sort of looking over at the PUC director, utility director on this, and saying I'm pretty sure they'll take that into consideration, and my guess is that Melinda, your attorney, will more than raise that as they participate in the case. From my experience, they're pretty effective at that.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I think our concern with it, the draft, is once you have you go through the docket process, because it is in statute, it really doesn't give us a lot to argue whatever they come up with, because their statutory approval, we then are subject to what the PUC tells the utilities to do.
But I would point out that it does talk about the cost and prudency. So I think you do have the ability to argue on this, on prudency.
Okay.
I appreciate your concerns. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay. Anybody have anything else? We will close the work session on House Bill, close the public hearing on HB 2193A. We'll open the work session. The chair will move House Bill 2193. Oh, I'm sorry. The chair moves the -8 amendments to House Bill 2193A. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? The amendments are adopted. The chair moves House Bill 2193A as amended by the -8 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion. Opposition?
I'm going to oppose it.
Huh?
I'm going to oppose it.
You're going to vote no?
Yes.
I'm going to be a maybe.
Jessica, would you just call the roll? I don't think that's a choice, Senator.
Mr. Chairman Rowe?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Maybe.
Senator Thompson.
She says. courtesy, maybe? I'll vote yes in committee, but I might change my mind on the floor. How's that?
Fine.
That's as maybe
fine
as I can get.
That's good
that's
enough.
Right. Okay.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Drodd.
I'll vote no and might change to yes on the floor.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Aren't you glad? House
Bill 2193A is passed to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Two maybes. Senator Girard opposed. And the chair will carry, and we will close on that. And unfortunately, we're out of time, so we will. All other bills, before I adjourn, are carried over. And that's it for the day. Thank you.